So we're good to go for Peter, right? All right. Good afternoon. Can you all hear me without reverberations? Is it vibrating? No? Okay. Welcome to this session. My name is Danelle Moon. I am the Director of Special Research Collections in the University Archives at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And I'm serving as the moderator of this panel. And so I'm going to, first of all, I want to thank you all for joining this session. We're really happy for the turnout. So we're really, this whole program is really focused on the contemporary book and its historical context as it's described in the RBMS guidebook. So you can read more about that. Some of the questions that came out as part of the process here for this program, if I could get this to go down. Okay. Actually was the result of a rare book school course that I was a party to with several other people from from our environments here and other places, where actually Peter Koch was teaching the class on the contemporary book. And we learned a lot from that class, and I thought it would be so interesting to have a session that would kind of pull together how printers actually think about the history of the book, how they might teach it, and what we might learn from that as scholars and teachers, and particularly in the area of the contemporary book and in the history of the art of the book. And so it was really a result of the California Rare Book School, which we have to give a big shout out to, and for Peter for actually running this class and really inspiring all of the participants in the class to come away with an idea of how we might actually come back to the classroom, or how we might work with our teaching faculty and our creative studies and some of the art programs that we are party to. And so I wanted to bring this together from that framework. What I'm going to do is introduce our speakers. And it was great that we could get these master printers to take the time to come to Iowa City, and to also be able to come here and, you know, give you their ideas on the philosophy of book arts. And I think it actually fits really nicely within the context of the theme of storytelling, because what they do as printers and as book artists is they're telling stories. Sometimes they're retelling old stories and putting them in a different framework or a different context from the whole art of the book, from the whole object of the book, looking at book bindings, to doing really interesting engravings, to reusing, you know, the words of some of the great classic writers. And that was one of the things that we really gained a lot of insight from Peter's class. And so we have to give homage to Peter for actually helping us think through some of these ideas. And so what I'm going to start with is just some brief, Peter's biography is 2 pages long, I'm just saying. but it's also very large print, so I can read it. So I want to introduce Peter Rutledge Koch, who is a designer, printer, artist, and writer. He founded the Montana Gothic, a journal of poetry, literature, and graphics, the Blackstone Press, and a letterpress, a printing office in Missoula, Montana, in 1974. In 1979, he served as the apprenticeship with Adrian Wilson at his renowned press in Tuscany Alley in San Francisco. Since that dissolution of the Blackstone Press in 83, he was published under numerous imprints named to suit different facets of his work. Peter Koch Printers, Hormone, Derange Editions, Editions Koch, et cetera, et cetera. Many of you are very familiar with all of the things that he has done, so across his the scope of his career. But I think one of the things that's really important to note here, and many of you have been participants of this, is that in 2005, he and Susan Filter, his wife, created the Codex Foundation to preserve and promote the art of the book, and is currently serving as the director of the Codex International Book Fair and Symposium. He's also taught the hand-printed book in the historical context from the 90s to the early 2000s. Where he did that actually at the Bancroft Library. I would go on and on and on here, but I'm not going to, because I think his the esteem that he's brought to this profession is very well known by all of us. And so I'm going to welcome him to come to do his talk, but I'm going to move to the next two so that I don't have to interrupt as we're going through that process. So Russell Merritt is a type designer. Russell is on the far end there. And for those of you who aren't aware, and he's also a private press printer working in New York City. He began printing in San Francisco as a teenager before apprenticing with Peter Koch in Berkeley and Firefly Press in Somerville, Massachusetts. He set up his own press at the Center of the Book Arts, New York, in 1993 and has been printing and publishing ever since. In 1996, Russell began teaching himself to design typefaces, leading to a 12-year study of letter forms before he completed his first typeface in 2008. In 2011, he began working to convert some of his type designs into new metal typefaces. Since then, he has produced 3 metal typefaces and 4 suites of metal ornaments. In 2009, Russell was awarded the Rome Prize in Design from the American Academy in Rome. His books and manuscripts are in public and private collections throughout the world. Russell. And then the smallest text is like, I'm going to really have to try and read this without glasses. So Gaylor Shalinek, in the middle here, noted for his color wood engravings, established his own press, Midnight Paper Sales, in 1980. Since then, he has published more than 25 books under his imprint, as well as accepted commissions, including works for the Gregonog Press in Wales and the Griller Club of New York. He has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the Carl Herzog Award for Excellence in Book Design and the Gregonog Prize. He is the honorary member of the Double Crown Club, is an active member of the Typophiles and the Ampersand Club and the Fine Press Book Association. His work is represented in most major book arts collections in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And the archive of his working materials is held at the University of Minnesota. Should also note that Peter's archive is at Stanford University. So just to point that out as well. So, I'm sorry. Did I not see that on here? Okay. So, well, really, you guys just slept all the way from these wonderful places. So thank you so much. So with that, I'm gonna turn it over to Peter. He's gonna start the talk. They're going to run for about 15 minutes each, and then afterwards we're going to have a time for participation from the audience and to ask questions about all of these interesting topics that we'll hear about today. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us. The time is short, and our tongues are long and ready for you. I can't imagine a finer audience than the one I'm sitting in front of, right, personally. I'm going to begin by just reading about three paragraphs, short paragraphs, to put in context what it was that inspired me to give the class that Danielle explained to you. It was the origin of this panel. I would like to demonstrate for you in what I'm going to show up on the slides, a vertical reading of books, similar in method to a vertical wine tasting. So in this case, what we're going to do is we're going to go down through the vintages of perhaps an idea. We'll call it an idea of vintage, and we're going to have a tasting back down into the past, or in other words, how do you arrive at the book that I make? The most fascinating metaphor that I learned in my philosophy classes at the University of Montana was the metaphor of the rower, and it was brought to my attention by my professor that when you are rowing a boat, and I knew this because I had spent much of my youth rowing a boat every summer on Seeley Lake in Montana, that you are backing into the future. Your back is to where you're going, and how do you navigate? The way you navigate is you pick a point is on the horizon or at the far end of the lake, and you keep that between your feet, and you try and keep it exactly 50% between your feet, and you just keep rowing, and you just don't have to turn around and look, but you also pay attention to the wake. because your wake will tell you if you're like going this way or that way, or whether you're going straight. So what kind of a rower are you? Are you a right-handed rower and everything is always going this way? So the metaphor of backing into the future as a way of navigating is how I began my concept of the third stream or total book, and which is a way that I've developed to understand what I think are the best books of my generation or our generations. A way of looking at the book or my own work, especially in the context of an ideal library. The ideal library is all of history. It's everything that we've got behind us. Where a deep so what I'm talking about is a deepest possible exploration of the materiality of language, transmission of text and images over millennia. A small spectrum of the books in that history, great history, fall under the loose category of the book arts. The third stream book, for me, is a relatively recent concept developing out of that I developed myself out of a close reading of The Seven Lamps of Architecture by John Ruskin, who is producing, in that, for me anyway, the concept of high craft and the unity of the arts. And I'm simultaneously reading or knowing about the idea called the Gesamtkunstwerk, which is the complete work of art that Wagner talked about when he said that he was going to present us with a unitary and total art form, like the opera, which has everything in it from painting to writing to music to sculpture to it's all there. So I think that with using these two readings on the Seven Lamps of Architecture about high craft and the concept of a total work of art, joining these two together, we can find a route by which to, or at least for myself, to begin to understand how to read a book. And that's about as much introduction as I need to say. That's where my theories are more or less from. Now, to give you my first example, I should preface this by saying quickly that I have three or four different specialties. This is just one of them, okay? But this is I'm going to show you a series of slides illustrating my thinking and how I arrived at three books. All of them are part of what I'm calling the Western Suite. As you can see by this illustration, from 1659, the image of the Pu Rouge or the Aborigine, as some sort of a Grecian princess or prince, can't tell what sex this animal is, but we know it's a cannibal. And this is how the people of America were early on portrayed. By the 19th century, we're portraying the American Indian as this noble savage sitting on a cliff overlooking the onslaught or the coming of civilization into their homelands. And usually the Indians are also showing a bit of astonishment or awe or reverence for what they're looking at down below because they see the obvious superiority. And what you can see at the lower left-hand corner is the the deforestation of the Midwest, for instance, and what you get is these fabulous farms. First you chop down the trees and then you till the soil. In the backgrounds, you have the churches, the colleges, the factories with the black billows of smoke, the steam boats that are bringing progress to the West, the Golden Gate Bridge, if you wish, out there. And these are the materials from which I'm deriving my contemporary thinking and thought. This is Captain Clark's field journal. It's wrapped in elk skin, elk hide. When you flip it over, it looks like this. And so it's a simple two or three signature book, empty notebook in which he's writing his thoughts. And he's carrying it in his shirt. When he gets up in the morning, he sticks it in his tunic and he gets on, gets onto the boat or slogs along the shore and he's writing and thinking. So that was the inspiration, those two slides were the inspiration for the elusive cover for my book, The Lost Journals of Sacagawea, which is a collaboration between myself and Deborah Magpie Erling, a Native American from the Kootenai Salish tribe, she lives in Missoula, Montana. She's a novelist who had written a novel I had read, and we met, and after much mutual admiration and backslapping and having a good time meeting each other, as we do, we're both from the same town, more or less. We're both from the Flathead Nation. I was born there, and my family had been, you know, living on Flathead soil for 100-some years. Her family goes back about as far as you can imagine. I just don't know how far. Here we have this thing. Now we have added to it because Deborah, spoke to me about a trade bead necklace that she saw at a powwow up in Arlee that had cartridges dangling from it. And so I said, "Oh, we can do this. There's the cartridges." You know, there was a 38 specials that my wife had fired through the handgun in order that we had our supply of pre-fired ammunition. When you open the book, what you see is that, once again, we're back in the historical record. This is a very poignant photograph. It is the surrender camp of the last Free Plains Indian. I don't know. You might not know about Spotted Eagle, but he's not quite as famous as Sitting Bull. But you've heard of Sitting Bull, the great war chief. Okay, well, Spotted Eagle and Sitting Bull each brought their tribes, families, north out of the United States to escape impoundment. And also, they left and went into Saskatchewan and Alberta on the rumor that there were still buffalo up there. So they were going to go in search of their food, and because they were starving to death. And their alternative was to surrender and eat beef. He went up to Canada. There weren't any buffalo after all. The Canadian government said, "We're not going to feed you. You're Americans, not Canadians, so you better get out of town here and go down there and surrender." And a photographer wandered into that bleak camp one day and took that photograph. The next page, when the next opening of the Lost Journals of Sacagawea, you see that happens to be a Piegan woman standing outside her home, a detail from a photograph that I own, but it's a 100-year-old photograph. This is the telling you that is the Lost Journals of Sacagawea. This book is the perspective from which it is written is of a 17-year-old pregnant Shoshone Indian girl who is accompanying her husband, Toussaint Charbonneau, up the Missouri River from the Mandan camp. And it is the story that Deborah reminds us in her text over and over again. It's the story that the white man won't hear and won't see. And so she's recording it for them. So the very first words in her diary, this is all a fiction by Deborah, is "There's no fever like the fever of white men building, the sound of trees falling. Building, they're building their houses. One day their buildings will devour the sky." And we go on and on and on and on into this long, long narrative in which she's recording her thoughts. And as time goes on, she becomes more and more prophetic. And traveling with these white men, she seems to be anticipating their future in her mind, in Deborah's mind as well. And so so they become these sort of shaped poems of encounters of the buffalo. And I don't know if you can read that, but the third line, unless I'm mistaken, reads, "This is the story that Lewis and Clark will not be writing down." As time passes, the buffalo hunters arrive and they slaughter all the buffalo. There are images of the last buffalo slaughters. There's images of this, like this. Now, this is, of course, the gang that got to town, and ever after it was safe for the white people to show up and do whatever it is they want to do. Mostly mining and I don't know, skinning of the buffalo and various sort of things. This happens to be a presidential Secret Service arrangement to bring a president of the United States out to Yellowstone Park so he can shoot himself a grizzly bear or a buffalo or something fun. And these guys, were the police force. But once they're there, it's really safe for these guys to show up. And these guys, you're looking at Last Chance Gulch in Helena, Montana. This is a magnificent photograph. There's almost nothing like it on the American frontier. My great-grandfather could easily be a member of the guy standing out there. He was there at the time. So some of the stories that I come by, that I tell in these three books that I'm going to illustrate, are I came by because my own family were there, and we have a lot of records. They were all a bunch of writing fools, and most of their books, most of their writings have been published. The grand finale of the last page of the Sacagawea book is harking back to that first page of text in which she says, one day their buildings will devour the sky. And this is Portland, Oregon, through which Sacagawea walked when on her journey. Now, another historic source for these kinds of works that I enjoy are photo albums. This is one of the rarest of all and most beautiful photo albums of the Hayden expedition and the William H. Jackson photographs of the Yellowstone National Park. These kinds of documents were used to convince Congress to build railroads, send money to build railroads, to send tourists and housing people, and these also to create the national park system. So these ideas were created for me. My volume is called, I didn't realize that wasn't a good enough photograph, Nature Mort. And the origin of the image, the first image in Nature Mort, is in fact this Oregon and Transcontinental Company stock certificate selling, and it's dated 1883. So these are moving people, and this vignette you will recognize when we get up real close. This is the opening, the first opening of the Nature Mort, and this is the image. Once again, it's the Pou Rouge on the cliff, you know, overlooking the advancement of civilization. And under the ZE, which you don't see, by the way, is one of those most gruesome mining scenes. You know when they come in with the hydraulics and they just wash away the side of the mountain and everything in it, and all you have left is this bare rock, and there's nothing there for the next, well, we are only 200 years out of some of these operations, but still nothing grows because, of course, there's no soil. We also have images that I'm using to bring into my work, and the ideas are coming from things like illustrated weeklies, obviously the intentional slaughter of the bison. These guys were just tourists having fun. They didn't even bother to skin them. They just shot them and drove on because they're just passing through on their way to the gold fields or something. And, of course, you know that eventually it becomes no more than a spectacle, right? Then we have the spectacular arrival of Colonel Cody, and the direct aftermath, is, of course, the first crop that people were able to harvest in places like eastern Montana were the bones of the buffalo and the bison. And this, for instance, is these bones are on their way to an ink factory. They will be partially burned and turned into bone black, which will be used in artist pigments and printing ink. Many of them were used for fertilizer, of course. So the images and the text that accompany this work, Nature Mort, are basically, from my point of view, postcards from the future to the past. And this is an earliest sketch that I have of my idea, where it came from. Looking at these glass plates, negatives, and writing in the sky above them like you do in a postcard you send, you write on in the blank space on the face of it if you run out of room on the back, and it ends up here. So this is obviously not a stereo because it's but I created a landscape by merging two different stereos. This is basically the last great slaughter. And I use the word still life. And I'm moving, type out of my cabinets and photographing it and using photographs. Typical example of where this is all leading, of course, is Geronimo's Last Buffalo. There are a lot of photographs like this of the Last Buffalo. They would lead some Indians out of their reservations and allow them one last buffalo before they, from ever after is beef, salted beef or whatever it is. And then this is that same surrender camp. In my, I wrote these two-syllable poems to create what I call an emblem book. This is moral teachings. This book that I'm trying to show you has its real origin in emblem books from the 18th century and the moral teachings of them. And so these are the subscripts, my little two-syllable poems. A freeze-out in Montana talk does not mean necessarily cold. It does mean, however, you lost your crop. You've been froze out or frozen out. And a freeze-out could have been a drought. It could have just been, you know, a real snowstorm at the last minute. Another origin of historical piece from which I'm getting my work are the real journals of Lewis and Clark, and these we photographed at the in Philadelphia at the American Philosophical Society, found the passages I wanted, photographed the passages I wanted, and then transferred them into the sky as if Meriwether Lewis was doing the writing, and here you have them standing on top of, I mean, the message being written on top of the half-breed buffalo bone pickers. Magnificent photographs about the size, about this big. And it's penciled on the back of that. It says, it has the title Half-Breed Buffalo Bone Pickers, Dakota Territory, 1888. And let me tell you, that's a fantastic image. What did that tell me? I'm over time already? Okay, I'm over time already, so I'll just quit. All right, so that's, I guess I have nothing else to say because I don't want to interrupt with my friends here. I had three more books to show you. I thought I was going to 20, but I won't bore you. You want to use this?
My slideshow is on it. We're both going to stand up here.
Get out of that.
Yeah, I'll do it. Let's get it. Okay. I think. Hi.
Boy, I'm slow, aren't I?
Whew. Oh, sorry. Hold on a second. This is Peter's computer.
The view from my deck.
The view from his deck. Everybody enjoy a little Berkeley. Okay. There we go. Good. So thank you. Happy to be here. we were all working on 20 minutes, and so Donnell said 15, but we're all doing 20, just so you know. but I'm really happy to be here, and I love the subject matter because I work with history a lot in my work. And when I think about it, there's sort of three general ways in which I work with history and in which I think generally artists do. And what's interesting is if you look at the output of the three great British private presses right from the start. Oh, sorry, Mark, you wanted to take a picture? Okay. okay, all right. You see those three ways of interacting with history manifest right from the get-go. And so I'll just walk through them. And so the first, we look at the Kelmscott-Chaucer. And although the Kelmscott-Chaucer is meant to evoke medieval book hands, evoke the medieval book, it is very much William Morris. It's William Morris's work. And the elements of it are not based on a specific historical example, trying to recreate a specific historical example, but trying to just evoke the time and evoke the feeling of it. And so I think of that as sort of indirect stylistic or thematic inspiration. And then you look at the Dove's Type, which is a great work of what I think of as mix and match appropriation. They look back in history, they like some letters by Nicholas Jensen and some by Jacob Rubius. They put them together to make something new, and what they come up with is a type that has as much to do with the punch cutter Edward Prince as it does with either Nicholas or Jacob's typefaces. So that's the mix and match approach. And then there's the Ashendene Press with their Subiaco type, which is what I call a genetic redrawing. It's meant to recreate perfectly a specific historic example. And in this case, the type of Sweynheim and Pinart's, including even the awkward capital H, which is missing its upper right finial. And so in thinking about these, I realized that these are the three ways that I sort of work with history. And as a type designer and visual artist, I'm self-taught. And so I started with more genetic redrawing as a way of teaching myself and imitating things that I liked. And now I'm certainly going more and more into indirect. And so I'm just going to show some of my work that is broken down into these three sort of categories. And so we'll start with the genetic redrawing. And for that, most of it for me has been with type design and letter design. When I first came up with an idea to become a type designer, I had no idea how to do it. So I started drawing letters that other people who I admired had drawn. And so this is my title spread for my edition of Prometheus Bound. It's the first book of mine that has lettering that I drew in it, just on the title page, and it was meant to be as close a redrawing as possible of the letters in this sketch by Jan van Krimpen. Anyone who's tried to redraw a historic form exactly will know it's not possible, but, you know, I do my best. And so that was in 2007, but it wasn't a typeface. It was still just a drawing of letter forms. And the next year, in 2008, I found myself looking at the typefaces of John Baskerville, not the horrible 20th century revivals of them, but the actual type. And I realized that I was falling in love with it. And the way I did realize that is because I was drawing it. But this was a huge moment for me because I not only drew the letter forms, but I made them into a functioning typeface, which meant I could actually print a book whose text was in it. And that just sort of opened the long closed gates. And the following year, I made my two sort of most advanced historical studies, which are the upright italic and the titling face from this book printed by Giovanni Battista Castiglione in Milan in 1541. It's his signature upright italic, and then what I call the Basel titling face, which appeared in Johann Froben's books in 1517. They look very light because they're a digital print. When they printed letterpress, they look heavier like the original. They're designed specifically to be printed letterpress. And these two typefaces were designed to print the texts in my book Ethelwald, Etc., from 2009, which is my most elaborate foray into mix and match appropriation. For those of you who aren't familiar with the book, it's a simple book. It's an alphabet, and each letter is inspired by a variety of historical sources that are then inform the design and to the point where the letter is meant to tell a story. And then in the back of the book, I write a short additional text to illuminate that connection, those various connections. So I'm just going to go through a couple of letters that show this approach. This is my H for Eudocus Hondius, the elder and engraver in the late 16th, early 17th century. He's most famous as a map maker. He bought Mercator's plates and issued a couple of revised editions of the Mercator Atlas. But like all engravers of his time, the way he could prove that he was a decent engraver was by publishing a writing manual. Everybody had to publish a writing manual because letters were a big part of the stock and trade of an engraver. So he made this beautiful Theatrum Artis Scribendi, and what's so remarkable about this book is it's so beautiful, and it's a lettering manual, and yet the worst part of it is the lettering. And it's completely mediocre, the lettering. But what I love about this book is how much insight it gives you into what Eudocus Hondius really loved to do. He loved to make these elaborate borders and cartouches. His maps have the most fantastic cartouches on them. And so I thought to make an H for Hondius, it had to be composed of parts from his cartouches. And so you can see there. So I'm taking different parts and making something new from them. And then the last one from that book I'll show is U for Utopiate, which is inspired by Thomas de Quincey's Confessions of an English Opium Eater, and particularly the part of the text in which he first purchases laudanum from the chemist on Oxford Street. And so I wanted the U to be in letters that would be used by on the signage of an Oxford Street chemist of the day. And so I looked to books like Sylvester's Alphabet Album for my U. But rather than using the linear shading, I decided it would be fun to make a sans-serif version of Thomas More's Utopian alphabet and set the text that inspired the letter in it, and by adjusting the leading between the lines, create the shading in the letter. So that's the so if you were to select the shading and change it to Helvetica or whatever, you could read the text that inspired the letter. But after that, you know, I really have been moving more and more into sort of, I still spend most of my time rowing backward into the future, but it's much more, much less specific. And so I'll just show a couple of books in that vein. Specimens of Diverse Characters is a specimen book of type designs that I designed. And for it, I wanted to really sort of grab... I had been working on this sort of complicated color printing in Ethelwald. And so I wanted to sort of dive into the stream of the 19th century chromotypographic book. When, you know, when chromolithography was rearing its ugly head, typographers started doing increasingly more complex books to show that, yeah, if you want a rosy-cheeked cherub, you go to the lithographer, but we can do some amazing stuff. And so books like Charles Darrier's Specimen Album, and, of course, William Page's Chromatic Woodtype book. And I wanted to, you know, make a book that was in that spirit of just, like, I'm going to do as much as I can. But, of course, I don't want to make books that look like William Page or Charles Darrier, and so this is... These are some pages from mine. This is all letterpress, except that. That's candle smoke in the middle of that. And this is a letterpress plate printed in Taglio. Oops, a crown of ivy. It's hard to see in this room, but every line of type in that poem is a slightly different color. And there's Alice. And then while working on specimens, I started also working to make some of my typefaces into new metal types. And for one of them, I wanted to make a type for a passage by William Morris. And for years, I have been studying this piece of work, the Verdunner altarpiece in the Klosterneuburg Abbey, by Nicholas of Verdun, and he made it in 1181. And it's 51 panels of Champlevé enamel, each of which has a tripartite arch with a biblical scene in it. And then it's surrounded by this just remarkably corpulent and fleshy type. I just love it. Not type, lettering. But every time I've tried to draw that lettering, what I end up with looks like some sort of cheesy greeting card from a church rectory or something. And so what I decided to do was to just sit down with a pencil and paper and draw 26 letters while thinking of Nicholas of Verdun. And so this is the type that I came up with. This is from my edition of the Book of Jonah. But so you can see it's obviously inspired by late Romanesque, early Gothic lettering. But if you compared the letters to Nicholas's, there's no real formal connection. And then the next big book that I did within the color printing range was my Interstices and Intersections, or an autodidact comprehensive cube. It's 13 propositions by Euclid, one each from each book of the Elements of Geometry that I chose because they resonated in my life somehow, and then wrote companion texts for each and illustrated both of them. And, you know, Euclid's Elements is really interesting from the book arts perspective because it's a book that for over 1,000 years has a documented history of being equally reliant on text and image for the explication of the text. The propositions are printed in type and they are then paired with a diagram, a visual diagram that helps you understand the proposition. And those diagrams were sort of formalized in the manuscript era and carried over into the printed book. And so you have, as a as a printer or an artist, you have a 1,000-year history of form, meditation on a single form. And so it's created a lot of innovative printing. And so you have Ratdolt's edition, which was very standard, but at the time, of course, was extremely innovative. And then Fra Luca Pacioli's edition in 1509. But then by 1570, you have John Day making an edition in which the stereometric book, the book 11, the forms in that are actually paper fold-ups where the reader can fold them up and make the three-dimensional forms. How am I doing on time? Good. Okay. And then he also has this section of cutouts where you can cut out and make your own dodecahedron and everything. It's just fantastic. 1570. And then, of course, there's the, probably the most famous Pickering's printing of Oliver Burns' first six books of Euclid. And so I wanted to work in this tradition, but I also was very aware that I was at risk of overly responding to the visual part of the text. And so my first step in the project was to make a 13-volume manuscript in which I proved every proposition in the elements so that I would relate through the text as well as the image. And these are the manuscripts. They're just paperbacks. But and then I spent a year drawing and writing, and so trying to make new diagrams that would relate to the history but be specific to mine. And so I'll just show a few spreads. So Euclid's text is in the italic and always shaped in a way that relates to the proposition. My text is in the Roman and only shaped if necessary. This, again, is all letterpress. And it's some fairly complicated letterpress. That's 10 colors. And that's 12 colors. And if you ever wonder why you don't see much 12-color letterpress, I can tell you. It is physically damaging. And when a book this size, with I did state and progressive proofs and all of this stuff, it is incredibly boring. Because in the end, you're just a bookbinder friend of mine used to just say, "Get a monkey to do it." You know, you're just cranking the press. And so, as soon as I finished this book, I went in and made my book Pressed for Time, and I finished them both in the same year. And they're the two biggest books I ever made, and they're all full of color and everything else. And while making Pressed for Time, I found this linoleum block that I cut in 1989 or 1990 about a book, story I wanted to write called He, about a man obsessed with geometry. And I found it in my parents' basement, and I could print from it. And I printed this beautiful black ink that was done after one crank of the press. And while I was printing Pressed for Time, I kept that print on the table and looked at it and dreamed. And I realized I had been drawing linear letter forms for a couple of years and that this is what I was going to do with them. And so I made a book, Linear A to Linear Z, which these are linoleum cuts. And, you know, just in the spirit of what we're talking about here, it was a really interesting experience to realize that I was making a book in which I was collaborating with my own history. And I'm just going to show these letters, and I'm going to cede the podium. What time did I come in at? Look at that, yeah. 15:33. Yeah. Well, so I was born in Mohegan Lake, New York. There you go. Thank you very much. We can all take a little break, 15 minutes, setting the bar real high. Play. All
right. Thanks, Russell, and thanks, Danelle, for inviting me here. I started out in the Red River Valley of North Dakota. And in spite of my mother's religiously taking us to the library to check out books, the first hint of something for me interesting beyond that straight horizon line was a record album. The first book was Letter to an Imaginary Friend by Thomas McGrath, a fellow North Dakotan, and it was about a 30 or 40 year long prose poem that he wrote that started in the 1950s in Los Angeles with the line, "From here it is necessary to ship all bodies east." This is a page from a book called Found Poems by Philip Gallo, and it's a fragment of an overheard conversation. Early on, I gained a reputation as a color wood engraver, and people were saying, "Well, so you can make us some pretty pictures, but what are you going to do for a text?" And thanks to Gallo, I never really worried all that much about that. I figured that text was everywhere, and it was just a question of recognizing it. Growing up in northeastern North Dakota, I thought I knew what cold was until I spent a winter in Wales. And this is the Gregonog Hall in mid-Wales, which late in the 19th century became an arts and crafts center. And the Gregonog Press was one of a number of British presses that sort of grew out of the private press movement, out of the arts and crafts movement. And in this building, which is not Tudor, by the way, it's made out of cement and it's painted to look like a Tudor building. They call it, there's something really Welsh about that, actually. But in this hall, there's a stairway, and beneath the stairway is a vault. And in the vault, they had all of the old Gregonog Press books, which I knew nothing about when I went over there. I fell for Agnes Miller Parker right away. I just loved the way she built compositions and her textures and lines. And I was there illustrating Whitman's poems from the Civil War. And I was getting a lot of help from Agnes Miller Parker, actually. This is a spread from a book that was published by the Grolier Club of New York in 1915, and it was sort of a celebration of the city at the turn of the 20th century, illustrated with wood engravings by Rudolf Huzika. And about 100 years later, they found the blocks in the library one day, and they sent them to me to reprint them. And I'd never printed anybody else's blocks before, much less needed to try and match someone else's colors. And I have that red-green color blindness thing. So it was very interesting and very challenging. Here you can see where Huzika had just sharpened one of his tools, and he was testing the point of the tool on the back of his block. And so the club had me make a sequel, a celebration of the city at the turn of the 21st century. And for me at that point, that was like the ultimate book project. I didn't know where to go from there. And I found myself back in Wales, in the little village of Hay-on-Wye, in a bookstore, where I came across F.M. Halford. And Halford was a fly fisherman who'd come out with a series of books on fly fishing around the turn of the 20th century. But they were very scientific in nature, and the idea of at least attempting to satisfy science interested me. So I did a study of mayflies, the text of which was a correspondence with an entomologist. My next book was going to be a Silva study of trees, and I often go visit my book dealer friend Rulon Miller when I'm looking for bookish inspiration. And so I went and saw Rulon. I said, "Hey, what do you have on your shelves with wooden boards?" And he pulled this off the shelf, and it's something called a Eusebius from the 16th century. And I didn't even need to open it. I just held it in my hands and just felt the weight of it and smelled it. And I thought, it'd be really interesting to try and make this bit brand new. And I'd heard that there was a collection of bookbinding models here at Iowa that were like historically based models. So I came here and I spent some time with Gary Frost, and I was hoping he'd bite. I was hoping he'd say, "Oh yeah, I can bind that edition," but he didn't. But he sent me to Craig Jensen down in Texas, who was able to execute the binding. So this is the cover of our large paper Silva, and physically and structurally it's the same thing as the Eusebius, but it's brand spanking new and it's got that new book smell. I decided to go ahead and include a tray of wood specimens, because when I was doing the research, I noticed a number of books with wooden specimens in them. They were usually like thin slices of wood. But I thought, well, if I did some specimens with this, I could sort of you know, tag along with that whole sort of historical lineage of the book. So it was pretty deliberate, really, to try and sell some books, I think. But
this should be an opportunity for me to go back there and show you the other 35 slides that I forget. I'm kidding. When I was teaching this class, I was taking the book, my favorite books, the books that I love more than any other books in my own collection, and then all the books that I've been teaching with at Stanford and at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Bancroft Library. And so I started bringing in exactly what you have seen today, Euclid's Geometry, the Pickering, Russell's book, the Hennepin, the Pike, various exploration journals of the upper Midwest that mentioned the Lake Pepin, and then, ta-da, there was Gaylord's book, and we showed, you've seen those wonderful drop-down maps, you know, where you see the profile of a river that is 12 feet long, and some of them were produced in the 19th century, and they were sort of like, let's go down the Rhine River, and you have illustrations of all the castles, you know, but you're on the river, and so I could bring out Carol E. Campbell's a Riverine Journey book that she printed of a W.S. Merwin poem. These examples were ways for me, and there were many of them. So in this class, we had the deepest collections available in California, or at least Northern California. We had some of the greatest, finest books that are done by contemporary artists, and I was contextualizing the contemporary books and trying to encourage the rare book librarians in my class, you know, to plunge deep into their collections and then collect today's books that they found spoke to them out of their own collection, so that they would have this same vertical tasting available to them anytime they wanted to show anybody a book. My theory seemed to work out. I mean, Danelle certainly enjoyed it, and there were 8 or 9 or 12 other students. To make a book talk to a book, to make a book speak to another, in other words, I tried to create a language in which books, the maker of the book is speaking to the reader, the book is speaking to other books, and the author or content of the book is speaking to everything and all of them. And so this way of looking at the contemporary work was also a way for us to promote the Codex Foundation, because these books that I was showing, for the most part, the contemporary ones, were all had been exhibited and bought and sold in the Codex environment. Now, this may look like an advertisement for Codex, and it is. You will find us all there. So many people in this room. We're grateful for you coming. And it's just another way for us to try to bring the contemporary book into its historical context.
Okay, so let's open it up to questions. There must be some questions out there. Okay, I'll start. So, Russell, when you were talking about drawing the letters,
yes.
Do you have training in calligraphy, or was that... So no. That was all just self-taught, or did you get that from art school?
No, definitely not. No art school. No school, really. But Peter, the school of Peter Koch. I remember the day. It was a November 30th, 1996. I was looking at a drawing of letters by Rudolf Koch, and I suddenly had a vision for a typeface. And the next morning, I got out of bed. I couldn't sleep all night. I was planning the letters, and the next morning I got out of bed and I considered myself a type designer.